righteousness. We would hope that would be all of us. And if you want to obey the eternal or seek God, we would hope the same thing, that we're all wanting to do that. It says, follow Abraham's example. At least follow Abraham's example when he did the right thing. He wasn't a perfect man. He made some mistakes, as all human beings do. But for the most part, we see an example of a person who lived by faith, who believed God, who trusted God, who obeyed God. So it says, look to the rock, or the rock from which you were chipped. That's Isaiah 51 and verse 1. It says, God chose Abraham and Sarah to be your ancestors. The Eternal blessed Abraham, and from that one man came many descendants. And when we read that opening passage there in Isaiah 51, we began to see that there is a pattern that is laid out in the life of Abraham, or Abram, before his name was changed. There is a pattern that God established in working in his life. And in most cases, there is a pattern in Abram's or Abraham's response to what God was doing in his life, both directions, that we see repeated time and time again as God works in the lives of the first fruits. So it is a very productive thing to do what it says here in Isaiah 51 and consider and study and think about and look at the example of God working in Abraham's life and Abraham responding to what God did. The first thing that we saw there in that pattern was that God, for the most part, calls individuals. He didn't call all of Abraham's family. In fact, part of his calling was to get away from his family and to leave the comfortable life that had been established by him, including family that was basically an idolatrous family, and to set out. And that's a theme throughout the Bible. Come out of her, my people, or be different from what the ways of the world that have surrounded you before you've known God. Come out of her. Leave those ways behind. So we see that in the life of Abram. Some people will say Abram had actually two callings. He was born in Ur of the Chaldees. Think Babylon. Think that part of the world. And that was a center of paganism in the post-flood and post-Tower of Babel world, Ur of the Chaldees. And then there's specific reference later in the Bible that Abram's father, Terah, was an idolater. So growing up, it would not be true to say that Abram was born into the church, the way we use that expression, or born into the faith. He wasn't. He came up in an idolatrous family, in an idolatrous community, and the early years of his life, he didn't know God at all. But the first calling of God to Abram was when he was called out of Ur of the Chaldees. And God said, and we read this last time, to a land that I'll show you. Just leave and I'll show you. I'll tell you when you get there. It took a lot of faith and a lot of trust in God to do that. Pick up and leave, not even knowing where he was going. And leaving all the familiar and even family members. But they didn't get all the way. In this first episode, they didn't get all the way to Canaan, to the promised land. They got only part way. They got as far as Haran. A little bit more about the family of Terah to fill in some gaps from what we talked about 2 weeks ago. Abraham was, Genesis 11, we can just look at it. He was the son of a man named Terah. And Terah, it says, had three sons, not just Abram. And if you put all the scriptures together, it's quite likely that Abram was not the firstborn. That's another theme that is repeated multiple times in the Bible. The line that God works through is not the one that you would anticipate if you went by what's expected. It was Isaac and not Ishmael. It was Jacob and not Esau. It was Joseph and not, different candidates, the firstborn of Jacob. But God chooses sometimes the second or the third. It was David and not his older brothers. And it's very likely that Reuben is what I was trying to say there. It was Joseph and Judah, not Reuben, who have the birthright and the other blessings because of Reuben's sin. But in any event, and we see this here, Abram is not the firstborn son of Terah. So God reaches down and he takes somebody that you would not have expected to be the one that gets the double blessing or the special blessing or the birthright blessing. But in any event, one of the brothers of Abram, one of the other sons of Terah, it mentions here in chapter 11 of Genesis and verse 26, is a man named Haran. Well, Haran died, we might say, prematurely. Haran didn't live to a full life, a full long life. He died well before even his father and well before Abram and the other brother, Nahor. And he had a son named Lot. So that's where Lot came from. He was the orphan nephew of Abram. He was his father, Haran, had died. But in this first call of God, yes, the father, Terah, was still alive. But God's focus was not on Terah, even though he was still alive and still nominally the head of the family. The focus was on Abram. God appeared to Abram, get you out of your country. So they left Ur of the Chaldees. God's primary focus is on Abram. Terah goes with them, but they don't get all the way to where they're supposed to go. They only get as far as, guess what, Haran, a town named after this dead son of Terah. So whether Haran was named after they got there, after they settled partway, they didn't go all the way. They didn't go all the way in response to the call of God initially. And I even think there we see a pattern that has played out down through the ages many times. Sometimes when God begins to work with somebody, they don't initially respond completely. Maybe a seed is planted and it lies dormant for a while. I was sharing with them up in Trenton today. I know that was the case in my life. And we're talking about Passover coming up before long. One of our traditions in our family when I have night to be observed is we ask people that join us at our home to just share a story or two that they feel comfortable about their history in the church, you know, the night to be observed coming out of Egypt spiritually. And on a number of occasions, we've heard similar stories where a person became aware of the truth. A seed was planted maybe early in life, and then it laid there somewhat dormant, or they went maybe a part way in responding to that, but not initially all the way. When I was just a boy, a teenage boy, my cousin and I would often go to my grandmother's house. I probably told this story before, for the weekend. And my grandmother played religious programs on the radio almost 24/7. It was just like the background music or static of that home. There was always 30-minute program after another. And I remember as an 11 or 12 year old boy, whatever it was, hearing the World Tomorrow program, and it sounded different to me. But I was pretty young, and I wasn't there to listen to religious programming, but I heard it. Kind of a seed was planted, I think. And then years later, 5 or 6 years later, I got serious about it. And I heard the same program, and I put two into it. That's what Grandma used to play, and I started listening to the content of it. Well, you could almost see that pattern here in Abram's life. He and his family went partway. They didn't go as far as the Promised Land. God says, get up, leave, and go to where I'll show you. Well, they got part way, and then they stopped. And some of the scholars say they probably stopped in Haran for about 5 years, something like that, several years, kind of halfway in response to this calling of God. But then Terah dies. He's an old man. He dies. And now, in every sense of the word, Abram is the head of the clan. He's the head of the family. And God appears to him a second time in Haran, and he says, no, go the rest of the way. This isn't where I told you to come or stop. And that's when they went into Canaan for the first time. So a little bit of additional background from last time. But we see these patterns that play out so many times. Jesus said something about the life of Abraham, why we should consider the rock from which we were chipped. And the Apostle Paul, on two or three occasions, wrote in Romans and the book of Galatians similar things. If we're really going to be Christians, if we're really going to be first fruits, we have to be, in a sense, children of Abraham. Jesus said that. Paul said it. If you are the sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus, this is what Paul said in chapter 3 of Galatians, for you're all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. But what else is associated with that identity, being a son of God through faith in Christ Jesus? He says, if you are Christ, then you're Abraham's seed. So you don't have to get too far from the identity of a first fruit before you run into Father Abraham. Jesus had said, if you were Abraham's children, which is another way of saying, if you're really one of my followers, you would do the works of Abraham. So we study the life of Abraham, the rock from which we were chipped, to see what his works were, how he responded to God's calling. Most of the time, he set us a very good example. On those occasions where he didn't set the best example, of course, we wouldn't follow that. But overall, his example was that of believing God, trusting God, obeying God. And in that sense, we should consider that and follow it. So anyway, that's a little bit of the background that we looked at last time. So we go to chapter 12. We just got started really in chapter 12 of the book of Genesis. And verse 1, now the Eternal had said to Abraham, get out of your country. See, he'd said it to Abraham even when Terah, his father, was still alive. But Terah wasn't the focus of God's attention. Abram was. Get out of your country. He had said this back when he was still in Ur of the Chaldees. Get out of your country, from your kindred, from your father's house. So some of the relatives, some of his cousins, that they left them back there in Ur, even when they traveled only partway to Haran for maybe about 5 years. He left his brother Nahor. See, one of his brothers, Haran, died. He took that boy's orphan son, Lot, with him. He went with his father was still alive, and he went with him. But Nahor, that other brother, and Nahor's family, he left behind. So he did leave some of his family, you could call it his father's family, behind. He left probably a pretty comfortable life back there in Ur of the Chaldees. And he just picked up in response to God, initially did well, and then maybe the zeal to go all the way into the promised land, something happened. We don't have the details, but they stopped short and stayed there for a few years. Finally, Terah dies, and God appears to him again. So this is part in the past perfect of what had been done, and then part what it's time to do now. And we see these promises that were made. I will make of you a great nation. That's verse 2. I'll bless you. So the calling of God has to do with growth from one man to a great nation. But it's growth you can't see, and you certainly don't see it in the short run. The calling of God to the first fruits involves things that are invisible in the present. And it's a matter of, are we going to believe God even though the promises seem impossible or not? I'll make of you a great nation. Well, how does a childless man envision himself being a father of a whole nation? Because he has faith in the God who promised it. That's the only way. He doesn't have to see it. He can believe it. So he walks by faith and not by sight. I'll make of you a great nation. I'll bless you. I'll make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. You shall be a blessing. Not only will you receive a blessing, you'll be a blessing. This is another theme in God's work with human beings. God chooses, let's just call it a conduit. He chooses the conduit through which he will give blessings to all. Well, sometimes those who are not chosen to be the conduit, but are chosen to receive the blessings when it comes out the end of the pipe, they get jealous of the conduit. They really shouldn't. I mean, God's God. He can choose the pipe he wants to put blessings in. It'll flow and then eventually come out to everybody. But the calling and the plan of God is eventually blessings for everybody, but it's in a programmed and systematic way. He first blesses the conduit, and then the blessings go through the conduit. Well, the person who says, I reject that. I'm not going to wait at the end of a pipe called Abraham or the promised seed. I'm not going to wait there for these blessings to get to me. I want them now, and I want them directly from God. Guess what? That person has rejected God's ways of eventually blessing him. And mankind in general has to learn that lesson. We don't dictate to God how he works out his plan. So people say, well, God plays favorites. He's playing favorites with this one family. You can call it however you want. I can call it however you want. The better way to say it is God is sovereign. Nobody tells God how to do his plan and how to eventually bless the whole world. God does that his way. So it's up to us to accept that in humility, you and me and everybody else, and not to be jealous. And that jealousy of who gets to be the conduit and who gets the blessings first explains a whole lot of world history. It explains anti-Semitism. It explains anti-Israel bias, even when people don't know who Israel is. even today, most people would not know that who the descendants of Joseph are in the modern world. But there is as much resentment and jealousy of the modern descendants of Joseph as of anybody. So it's a satanic worldview that resents the conduit through which God says he would bless many. Joseph was to be a blessing to many, an overflowing bough through which many blessings would come. So we see so many themes. So not only will you receive a blessing, but you'll be a blessing. And I'll bless those who bless you, and guess what? I'll curse those who curse you. So those who oppose the conduit, they may in the short run be able to do a lot of damage to the pipeline. They may be able to kill Jews, kill Israelites. They've been doing it for thousands of years, but again, eventually God will take vengeance and make things right. I'll curse those who curse you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And all families of the earth have to come to terms with that essential way that God will send his ultimate blessings to everybody. And of course the greatest there is the spiritual blessings to all nations, the seed Christ. But there's a physical aspect to it as well. All right, so those are promises. They're magnificent promises. And at the time that those promises were given, none of them were fulfilled. And there was no immediate prospects that any of them will be fulfilled. It's all the future. And yet, quite simply, it says Abraham departed. He believed God, and he departed as the Eternal had spoken to him. And Lot went with him, and Abraham was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. So this is sort of this second calling, or this, you know, recharging the batteries of responding to God's call. Father Terah is dead, and so in Haran, God appears to Abram and kind of gently reminds him, this isn't where you were supposed to stop. The land that I'm going to give to you is on beyond. So there they went. All right, so we come to verse 6 of chapter 12. Then Abram took Sarah, his wife. Now it's made very clear. Later we're going to get this wonderful half-truth, this white lie that she's my sister. No. Pure and simple, wife. Might have been a relative. You might be able to turn yourself into a pretzel and call your sister because she's a second cousin or something. No, she's your wife. And we sometimes see Abram not at the top of his game. Not at the top of his game. Maybe make some mistakes. Maybe compromise a little bit. But God is very honest. And so we don't follow Abram. We shouldn't when he makes a mistake, something he'll have to repent of later or grow up from. But anyway, clearly, Sarah is his wife. There's no aspect of this description, this divine description, that would say sister. No, it's a wife. All right, and Lot, his brother's son, his dead brother Haran's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran. So here's another theme we see. When God is working with somebody, they won't always get it right. They will make their mistakes. Sometimes in a weakened state, they might compromise a little bit. We see God not just casting them aside. It's not one strike and you're out. He continued to be blessed, even in Haran, even when he shouldn't have been in Haran. There were some blessings, and we see that down through the ages. God doesn't withhold all his involvement in a person's life that he's working with just because they make a mistake. Now, there are limits to that, and God has his limits. But God is capable of continuing to bless, in some ways, people he's patiently working with. Clay in his hands. He might have to start over a time or two on the potter's wheel. All right, so anyway, he had received many blessings, even in those years in Haran, where he probably didn't belong there. But there were still great possessions they had gathered. And the people whom they'd acquired, servants, he had quite a retinue of servants, as we'll see here in a little bit later today, that had their allegiance to Abram. They departed to go into the land of Canaan, where they should have gone in the first place. That was the promised land. So they came to the land of Canaan. And Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Morah. Now, that could easily just be something that we read right over. Why wouldn't he just stop the first place he came to in the promised land? Well, let's remember, there were people already living there. There were Canaanites already living there, all these tribes that already lived there. And why didn't God dispossess those people now? Well, it wasn't time to dispossess them now. He was going to allow them to stay there for a while. In one case, it says, because their iniquity is not yet full. So we see, even though people are living idolatrous, iniquitous lives, again, God doesn't crush them and wipe them all out immediately. It would be very rare that that ever happens. But in God's working out of his plan, sometimes he will continue to let people enjoy good land or a good blessing, even though when they've turned their back on him, giving them more time. It wasn't yet time for these people to be dispossessed. So they're already there. And here comes this foreigner coming through their land, looking for some land to settle on. He had to pick his spots. He had to keep going until he found some open, unoccupied land. So he continued on. He passed through the land until he found a place where he wouldn't immediately be opposed by those who said, you know, you can't stay here. This is our land. So he moved on until he comes to this place near this particular tree that is mentioned, and that's where he settles. Yeah, it says the Canaanites were there in the land at the end of verse 6. He couldn't just go anywhere he wanted at that point. All right, so verse 7, then the Eternal appeared to Abram. This wasn't the first time. And he said, to your descendants I will give this land. This is another theme we see in God's working with the first fruits. He keeps their eyes on the indefinite future. He didn't say, unto you, right now, you can have all this land. Abram had to look, as God did, to the future when he would receive these blessings. And you know what? He died not having yet received them. Read the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. All these died not having received the ultimate promise of eternal life, but even some of the promises that are made in these chapters. Abram never saw the fulfillment of those in his life. Abraham didn't. So he continually had to look to the future and to trust God to fulfill his promises, even though there were long delays. A lot of waiting involved for those who are first fruits. It's a life of waiting, of looking to the future, and of being patient. In fact, he didn't die with much land at all. Just about the only land, just about the only real estate that Abraham owned when he died was a cave in which he buried his wife. Other than that, he wasn't really a landowner in the land of promise. But his descendants would be, and he kept believing in God's promise. It says in the book of Romans, he believed that what God had promised to do is able to fulfill. And he left it up to God, the timing. Sound familiar? You and I are living a life that's based on a promise, a series of wonderful promises, big promises. And yet we haven't seen it yet. Some of us have been waiting a while. Some of us have been waiting a long while. And we'll keep waiting. The life of a first fruit is a life of waiting, patiently, knowing that God is working it out on his time schedule. And not of saying, I'm going to give you 10 years, God, 20 years, and then that's it. Then I'm out of here. We follow Abraham's example. If we're chips off the old block of Abraham, he died not having received the promise, but still believing. All of them, the physical as well as the spiritual. So it's to your descendants I will give this land. And there, he had a choice to make. Like any human being would have a choice to make. When God lays out the terms of the deal, human beings could either say, that's fine with me, and humbly accept it on God's terms, or they could say, wait a minute, time out, God. I want it now. Or I don't want it some other way, I want it my way. Or I don't want it there, I want it here. Well, all of those would be the wrong responses. What Abraham did is worship God. He built an altar. It's certainly evocative of a person who has humbled their will to this whole thing on God's terms. So he built an altar. He didn't question. He didn't whine. He didn't complain. He built an altar to the Eternal who had appeared to him. And he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel, not too far from Jerusalem. And he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Eternal and called on the name of the Eternal. So Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. So he lived the life of a nomad. He's supposed to be an inheritor, a great landowner, and he's a nomad living in tents. But the promises were for later. Now we come to a series of verses, beginning in verse 10, that doesn't show Abram, it doesn't show him at the top of his game. It doesn't show the best period of his life. God didn't say go to Egypt. He said go to Canaan. That's your land. And you can maybe navigate around within Canaan, but that's where I want you to live. So what's he doing down in Egypt? Do the first fruits always get it right? Do the first fruits have a protective bubble around them so that no problems ever come calling? And if problems do come calling, do the first fruits always react perfectly? Well, no, no, and no. And we see that. First case, verse 10, there was a famine in the land. Well, if this is God's special guy, why didn't he let it be a famine everywhere else? But wherever Abram stayed, why couldn't there just be one cloud pouring down gentle rain right over him? It didn't work that way. This was a widespread famine or widespread drought, and he participated in it. Well, what are you going to do when you've got flocks and herds and there's no rain? There's no rain, there's no pasture grass. And if there's no pasture grass, all your animals are going to eventually starve. Well, I guess that'd be too hard for God. God, there's no way God could ever provide for Abram. This was another test of faith, I believe. And we see Abram using a little bit of too much human ingenuity or human reasoning. Is anything too hard for God? Actually, that's something God asked Abram later when it came to having a miraculous baby. And when they laughed, God himself said, is there anything too hard for me? Well, he was never really authorized by God to go down into Egypt, but he did it anyway. He used his mind, he came up with a human solution, and he broke into jail. He got into a lot of trouble down into Egypt that he didn't have to be in. Let's read it. Came to pass when he was close to entering Egypt, and there the human reasoning starts. He said to Sarah, his wife, not his sister, his wife. She might have been a second cousin or something like that, whatever it was. But now we know clearly the way God looks at it, it's his wife. He said to Sarah, his wife, indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance. Therefore, it will happen when the Egyptians see you that they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Some powerful local king would kill the husband and take the wife into his harem, and that'd be the end of it. That's the way it was done back in those days, apparently, commonly in the ancient world. So I guess it'd be too hard for God to protect you, Abram. This is something you're going to have to work out on your own. That would be too big of a problem. God could not possibly come up with a solution. Well, so let's come up with our own solution. Let's lie. It's not really a lie. It's a white lie. Please say that you're my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you. That I may live because of you. Now, they may still take you into their harem, but they at least won't kill me as your husband. Again, this is perhaps not Abram's finest hour. Please say that you're my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you. So it was, when Abram came into Egypt, that the Egyptian saw this woman, that she was very beautiful. I mean, he had analyzed it well. He could foresee, you might say he had discernment, but was he putting his faith totally in God for God's solutions in God's way? Maybe not so much on this occasion. The princes of Pharaoh also saw her and recommended her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house, just exactly as he feared. He treated Abram well for her sake. He had sheep and oxen and male donkeys and male and female servants, female donkeys and camels. But the Eternal plagued Pharaoh and his house. Does God withhold all blessings and all intervention on behalf of the first fruits when they get something wrong? It doesn't appear so in this case. I don't think this is Abram's finest hour. But God is pretty stubborn and determined. He's my guy. And I know he's not yet perfect, but I'm still going to take care of him. And I think that's another theme in God's workings through the age. Now, again, there are limits, and sometimes God does do this and does that, and he corrects. There's no question about that. But we don't just see him throwing Abram overboard every time he makes a mistake. Abraham, just like everybody else, has to grow. He has to mature. He has to learn more. He has to make his mistakes and then grow from it. So anyway, so Pharaoh called, but the Eternal plagued Pharaoh, verse 17, and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And so Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you've done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife?" Well, it ought to be self-evident why he didn't. But he's actually correcting God's servant, and in this case, he's right. You shouldn't have lied to me. Well, no, you shouldn't. Why did you say she's my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. So she was taken into the harem, but not yet had Pharaoh committed adultery with her. So God even protected Sarah. But it sounds like it was a close call. "Now, therefore, here is your wife. Take her and get out of here. I don't want anything more to do with you." So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. This is an episode in Abram's life which generates some questions, some of which I already asked, legitimate questions. Do those who have been called by God always get it right? If we see somebody that we know is going to be in the first resurrection do something, does that automatically mean that God puts his approval on that? Well, how could we possibly believe that? Don't we know David's going to be in the first resurrection? How could we possibly put our approval on David's sin with Bathsheba? So no, just because the Bible records something that a man of God did does not automatically mean that we should assume God puts his approval on that. Sometimes God shows the mistakes of even the heroes of the faith. Did Abram in this case, on this occasion, show real faith and trust in God? Did he even show a willingness to suffer for righteousness' sake? Just tell the truth and take the consequences? Compare this to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We're not going to bow down. Throw us in the furnace. God will either let you kill us or he'll protect us, but we're not going to compromise. In that case, they got it better. They got it more right than Abram did on this particular occasion. Do the faithful ever, in a weak moment, demonstrate a lack of faith, even though the overall record of their faith, of their record, is they believe God? Do they ever have moments when their faith is weak or compromise? Do the saints ever use fallible human wisdom, deceiving themselves that it's really godly wisdom? This whole plan he concocted wasn't from God. So the answer is yes, sometimes we see these things. Do even the good guys ever have anything to repent of or to be ashamed of? Did Abram set a perfect example? As we consider the rock from which we were chipped, do we want to be like him in every regard? No, only in the ones where he got it right. So I think these are interesting thoughts to have as we go along in the story. Now at this point, probably a repentant Abram goes back where he should have been in the first place. So we come to chapter 13 and verse 1. Abram went up from Egypt. He really didn't belong down there. And he and his wife and all that he had and Lot with him to the south. And Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. I think we're going to see now the scene switch and shift to seeing maybe him in one of his better moments that we really would want to emulate following this not so good moment, what we would not want to emulate. It says he was still very rich in livestock and silver and in gold. Now verse 3, so he went on in his journey from the south as far as Bethel, back to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, kind of getting back to where he belonged. Maybe almost a second conversion, but at least getting back to where he belonged. Verse 4, to the place of the altar, which he had made there at first. And there Abram, again, called on the name of the Eternal. Just a way of expressing that he strengthened and reestablished his relationship, his close relationship with God. Verse 5, Lot also. Now, we don't want to get the idea that Lot's just, I mentioned him, he's the nephew, he's the orphan son of Abram's dead brother. We don't want to have the idea he's a young boy or even a teenager. I mean, he's a grown adult man. But he still really is second in authority. He you might say, second in command, second in prominence in this clan that is now led by Abram. Let's keep that in mind. He's second. He's not first. Abram is first, and rightfully so. So, verse 5 again, Lot also, who went with Abram, he had his flocks and his herds and his tents. He was also a powerful and wealthy, blessed individual. And then we come across a problem. After the Egypt incident, we get kind of a range war going here. We get a possible very serious interfamily difficulty arise. Maybe not initially between Abram and Lot directly, but between their herdsmen and those that reported to each of them directly. We get a problem developing because there doesn't appear to be enough good pasture land for all of their livestock. The land was not able to support them, verse 6, that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And so there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. So the way it's presented, it wasn't initially between the two top men directly, but it percolated up. And also they were still living in an area where surrounding them there were these native pagan tribes. The Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelt in the land. Now how would this problem best be solved? How would the human mind, how would human nature approach this impasse? Well, one way would be for Abram to say, look, I'm number one, Lot, you're number two. Let's keep that straight. I'm the big dog, you're the little dog. I have first choice, you get second choice. So we're going to have to split up. I'll take what I want and give the rest to you. He would have had the legal right and the cultural right to do that. But would that have been the most converted approach? And is it the approach that he took? Well, you know the story. None of that did he do. This is Abram in one of his most converted moments, if we can put it at top of his game. What does he say instead? Verse 8, he says to Lot, please let there be no strife. First of all, let's live at peace. That's more important than anything else. Let's don't have a long-standing dispute which would cause bitter feelings down the road. Let's not have strife between you and me and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen. Let's figure out a peaceful solution. Let's keep the end in mind. Peace. Respect. Verse 9, is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. We're going to have to divide up, and one of us is going to have to go where there's better grassland. But you know what? I'm going to let you pick first. You pick first. Whatever you don't take, I'll take what's left. Now, in an ideal world, Lot would have probably said, no, I can't do that, Uncle Abraham. I'm second, you're first, you should go first. And they might have had a brief tiff. You know, it says in New Testament, in honor, prefer one another. If you're going to have an argument, so you can give more honor and more generosity to the other one. Ideally, perhaps that's what Lot could have done, should have done, but he didn't. We don't want to be too hard on him. But Abram takes the leadership, and he says, no, I want you. You pick where you want to go, and I'll take what's left. And I'll just trust God to make it work. So, please separate from me. If you take the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. And so Lot lifted up his eyes and saw what looked best, and he took it. He cashed that check, that blank check that his uncle had given him. And it was well watered. See, right now they're both to the west of the Jordan River and the Jordan Valley, which was very lush pasture land, the best land, well watered by the Jordan River. They were both west of that. And so the best land is east, going toward the valley, toward where there's water. And that's what Lot looked at, and that's what he chose. But, there's always a but, isn't there? That's real close to Sodom. And so when he took what humanly seemed to be the greatest blessing, he got closer and closer to a very sinful city. And I think there's a lesson in that for us. Sometimes we choose or could be tempted to choose things that on at one hand look the best, but we might be getting closer and closer to temptation or sin. And that's exactly what happened with Lot. As I say, we don't want to be too harsh on Lot. We're going to look at an overall description of his life, even in the New Testament. But that's what he did. He took the best land, the best cattle grazing land, but he got closer and closer to the sinful cities of Sodom and Gomorrah by doing that. So Lot lifted up his eyes again, verse 10. He saw all the plain of Jordan. It was well watered everywhere before the Eternal destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Eternal. It was so beautiful. It was like the Garden of Eden. Such a perfect pasture land, like the land of Egypt as you go toward Zoar. So Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and he left Abram back in the west, in the less beneficial land, at least to human eyes. But he left Abram further from Sodom and Gomorrah, too. Let's don't forget that. So verse 12, Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan. Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent, even as far as Sodom, right up to the, maybe not inside the city limits initially, but right up to the edge, at least very close, as far as Sodom. Then, of course, we get this description, but the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Eternal. And the Eternal said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him. So now God is going to show Abram again, I can take care of it. I can make things work out in ways that your human eyes would never anticipate. I'll bless you. You did the right thing, and I'm going to really remind you of my ability to bless you. So he appears to Abram again. He says, lift up your eyes from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. Even look to the good land that Lot just took, and realize that in the long scheme of things, you're going to get it all. You're not going to get it right now. Lot took it right now. But in the long term, if you can keep your eyes on the long term and the overall plan, you're going to get all of it, you and your descendants. It'll all be yours. For all the land which I give to you, you see, I give to you and your descendants, and how long? Forever. So when God is dealing with first fruits, he keeps their mind on the long term, even the eternal long term. And so we're certainly reminded that there are eternal consequences to being a first fruit, beyond even this lifetime. As I said, when Abram or Abraham died, he was not a big landowner. He's promised to be a huge landowner. He had one cave. It was his legal possession. I'll make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, earlier he had said, if you could number the stars in the sky. And how many children do you have to start out with at this point? None. So he had to believe in incredible things, that nothing is too hard for God, and he could choose to believe it or disbelieve it. Arise, walk in the land through its length and its width, for I give it to you. Eventually, it's yours. Just trust me to give it to you when I'm ready to give it to you. Don't worry about who gets it in the meantime. Then Abram moved his tent and went and dwelt in the terebinth trees of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and built an altar there to the Eternal. He's always building altars to God. He's always worshiping God. He's reestablishing and strengthening his worshipful relationship with God. Abraham at his best, I think. He's habitually making God the center of his life, and he is blessed for it. We're going to come back. We'll pick it up in chapter 14 in a little bit. But I want to go elsewhere in the Bible and see how these themes that we've just seen in the first couple of chapters of Abraham's life as a first fruit are repeated and emphasized many times throughout the Bible, because it's the way God deals with the first fruits. What were some of the principles, godly principles, that Abram employed in this post-Egypt incident that we just read now here in chapter 13? Well, we find a number of them mentioned in the book of Proverbs. So let's go to the book of Proverbs for a few minutes and tie some things we see here. Godly principles, ways to deal with challenges in life that we see Abram utilizing or employing. Let's first go to Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 25. Isaiah 51 said, consider Abraham. Consider what he did. Jesus said, if you're a child of Abraham, you do the works of Abraham. All right, let's tie some of this together. This is Proverbs 11, verse 25. The generous soul or individual will be made rich, and he who waters will also be watered himself. I think that really ties beautifully into the story we just read in Genesis 13. It was about water, watered pasture land, and Abram basically gave Lot and indirectly watered Lot's possessions, and he trusted in God to make it work out. But he was generous. He was generous. He was not selfish. He was not me first. He was generous. And we see that beautifully illustrated. The generous soul shall be made rich or will be blessed. And as soon as this happened, God appears to Abram and says, I'm going to bless you greatly. It's going to be in my time, but you will be rewarded. We go also to chapter 22 in Proverbs. 22 and verse 9. 22:9. He who has a bountiful eye, a generous eye, who's willing to be generous with others, will be blessed. For he gives of his bread to the poor. So we certainly see Abram practicing generosity. It's a godly principle. Let's also go back to chapter 16 of the book of Proverbs. And we also see humility. We see Abram, who was the chief of the clan, humbling himself, really, in the presence of Lot. We don't see arrogance, pride. We see humility. Well, here in Proverbs 16 and verse 19, it's better to be of a humble spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. You know, take the spoil, take the best position, the best portion. He humbled himself and let himself, you might even say in the vernacular, he let himself be taken advantage of. Well, in the New Testament, Paul was dealing with a problem at the church in Corinth, and he says, why aren't you at least willing to suffer wrong? Why aren't you willing to draw the short straw to buy peace? We see Abraham putting a high value on peace, peaceful relationships, and he paid for it. In the short run, he paid for peace. It was more important than short-term gain. So there we have it, Proverbs 16, verse 19. It's better to be of a humble spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. And then also in chapter 29, all this is in Proverbs. Proverbs 29, again, humility. We see Abraham using or representing being humble. Chapter 29 and verse 23. A man's pride will bring him low, but the humble in spirit will retain honor, will be blessed. And right after this act of humility, God appeared to him and reminded him of the great blessings that he would receive. There is, well, now you're holding your place two areas. Stay with Proverbs. Put a marker there. I want to briefly go somewhere else. We'll come back to Proverbs. But there's another character trait of God or godly people that we see here, and it's talked about in the New Testament. Let's look at Philippians chapter 2. We see Abraham doing this. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than himself or others' interests ahead of self. We really see on all fours what Abram just did with regard to this potentially very explosive family issue. He esteemed the other person, Lot, ahead of himself. And that's a New Testament, spiritually mature principle. Go back to Proverbs again. We see another thing, the way it's expressed here, that Abram did in one of his finest hours. Proverb 25, verse 15. Here it is in the New King James. 25:15. By long forbearance, a ruler is persuaded, and a gentle tongue breaks a bone. I mean, he could have gotten into an argument, and it could have escalated with Lot, but a soft answer, you know, another way of saying a soft answer turns away wrath, and it just dissipated the tension. And so you and I can learn from that, seeing it in action as we consider Abraham's life. Soft answer, also chapter 15 of Proverbs. I mean, there were other things he had every quote-unquote right to say. But he put those on the shelf, did these other things, and instead of throwing gasoline on the fire, he threw sand and put it out. Proverbs 15 and verse 18. Wrathful man stirs up strife. Lot, I need to remind you just who you are and who I am. You seem to have forgotten. You seem to have gotten a little bit too big for your britches. I mean, Abraham could have said those things. And he probably would have been right. But why didn't you take charge and tell your herdsman to defer to my herdsman? Who's the head of this family? He could have said all those. Didn't say any of them. That would have only provoked Lot, more than likely, to greater anger. But in chapter 15 of Proverbs and verse 18, a wrathful man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger allays or puts out contention. And so there's just so much that we can admire about this example. Chapter 28 of Proverbs. Simply put, he trusted God to work it out. He did a much better job of this than in the whole Egypt episode that we read earlier. I think we see growth here. Proverbs 28 and verse 25. He who is of a proud heart stirs up strife, but he who trusts in the eternal will be prospered. In the short run, it looked like he was reducing his own balance sheet by letting Lot choose first. But he just was going to trust God to make it all work out. And of course, God did. What could have been escalated into a family-destroying hot dispute, it was put out. We see Lot making a bad decision, or a less than perfect decision, I think, by comparison. I still say he could have said, no, I can't take up your generous offer. Or, okay, I'll go first, I'll choose the bad land. I mean, he could have done that. He didn't. He wasn't a perfect individual either. But before we get too harsh with Lot, you know, his name isn't mentioned very often in the New Testament. But one time where it is near the very end. And let me just read it with you here. 2 Peter, this is long after God's judgment has been determined about Lot's future. We can see some mistakes that Lot made. Yes, we can. But let's read this when it's all over, final evaluation comment. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 7. What is he called? What does God inspire Peter to say about Lot? Lot's in his grave awaiting a resurrection. Which one's it going to be? 2 Peter 2 and verse 7. He delivered righteous Lot. I'd take that. If there's going to be one mention of my name in the New Testament, I'd take that as the adjective, wouldn't you? Righteous Lot. So, again, we see, I think, even God's mercy, his forbearance. Not that he compromises, but he's patient. He looks at the overall track record, some of those thoughts. Righteous Lot. Why are we taking all this time to read about Abram? 1 Corinthians 10 tells us. Well, one answer is we're doing what it told us to do in Isaiah 51. But here in 1 Corinthians 10, it tells us why should we go back and really look in detail at some of these old stories. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 6. We're to learn from them. That's why they're here. That's why they've been preserved. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 6 says, these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And then in verse 11, these people that lived way earlier, and verse 11, all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, our growth, our ability to learn, on whom the ends of the ages have come. So let's now go back to Genesis, read a little bit more, hopefully learn a little bit more, see God's dealing in the life of Abram and his reaction to that. Genesis 13 again. I want to pick it up now in verse 14 again and just emphasize a couple of different things here. The Eternal said to Abram, 13:14, after Lot had separated from him, "Lift up your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward, for all the land which you see I give to you and your descendants forever." That's a promise, but it wasn't fulfilled in his lifetime. He had to go to his grave trusting in God to fulfill promises that he had made and never doubting. "And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth," and so on, that you can't even number them. "Arise, walk in the land, all of its dimensions, and I will do that." And then it says, Abram moved his tent, went and dwelt in the terebinth trees of Mamre, and again he built an altar to the Lord. Abram's overall assessment of God is that he's worthy to be worshipped. He's not worthy to be argued with, resented, second-guessed. He's worthy to be worshipped. Okay, let's look at chapter 14 now. Well, if we had a range war in chapter 13, we got another turf battle, but on bigger scale. We've got a turf battle here in chapter 14. The background is this. Way far to the east of where Lot and Abram are now living, way far to the east, lived, think Babylon. Kind of back where Terah's family initially came from, Ur of the Chaldees, the Chaldean land. Way over there, later think of Babylon and Persia in that part of the world, the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. There were four powerful kings. And they were powerful enough that in previous times they had come over to Canaan, conquered certain of the tribes, and put them under tribute. That's the way it was done in the ancient world. Saying, we won't come back and kill you all, but every year you got to send us tribute. You got to send us a portion of your crops or your livestock. You got to pay us rent to live on this land. And this had been going on for a number of years. These four kings, the four kings of the east. Well, something had recently happened. There were five lesser kings in Canaan. Tribal leaders or city-state kings, call it what you will. They weren't as powerful. But they were the ones in the land of Canaan. They were the ones there that were living, and they were having to pay rent and tribute to these four powerful kings way to the east. And they get tired of that. Most people would get tired of that after a while. We work hard, we want our own increase, but we got to pay a lot of it to these absentee landlords, put it in modern terms. So they quit paying rent. The five kings of the west over in Canaan, they decide, we're just going to quit paying rent. We don't even think they'll bother with us. We're so far away. Well, they were very wrong. So the four kings of the east decide to put together, this is what they did in ancient times, put together an army, and we will go and we'll forcibly take rent. We'll kill a bunch of them. We'll take a bunch of their stuff, and we'll say, don't ever do that again. So that's what we see in chapter 14. And guess who gets caught up in the middle of all this? Lot and Abram. They're right where all this action is. They didn't start it, but they get caught up in the middle of it. And it's quite a story. So let's look at it. Chapter 14. It came to pass in the days. Now here are the four absentee kings of the east, back over in the area of Babylon. One of them named Amraphel, the king of Shinar. Arioch, the king of Eliasar. Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam. And Tidal, the king of nations. Four powerful kings. They made war with Bera, the king of Sodom, Birsha, the king of Gomorrah. Well, those two cities we are familiar with, Sodom and Gomorrah. They each had a city king. That's two of the five. Shineb, the king of Admah, Shimeber, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, the five resident ones. who are rebelling against the kings of the east. All these, local five, they join together, verse 3, in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea, down around the Dead Sea, around the area of Sodom and Gomorrah. We're going to quit paying rent. Let's all join together, and they won't bother us. Again, very wrong judgment. 12 years they served. They've been paying rent or tribute for 12 years. In the 13th year, they said, we're tired of this. In the 13th year, they rebelled. All right, it takes about another year for the four kings of the east to get their armies put together. Now, one thing about the geography of this, if you look at the Bible maps you have, it would have, as the crow flies, it would have been a lot straighter just to go from where these four kings were straight to down near the Dead Sea, where these five were, just to go straight. Problem, there's a desert in between. So they don't go straight. They take this long, circuitous route. They go counterclockwise, curve way up and around, and then they come down the east side of the Jordan River. That's what's being described in the next few verses. The four very angry kings of the east, the absentee landowners, they're coming to exact vengeance. And it's this big circuit. That's what's happening. So let's see what happens. Verse 5 there. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer, and he was the chief among the four, and the kings that were with him, came and attacked the Rephaim and Ashtaroth-Karnaim and the Zuzim in Ham. This is along the way. They just happened to find other people in their way, and they decided to slaughter them too on the way to putting down this rebellion. The Emim in Shaveh Kiriathaim and so on. Verse 6, and the Horites in their mountains of Seir as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness. Then they turned back and came. So they've done this arc, and now they're going to go straight south down the east side of the Jordan River in the Jordan Valley to go after the rebels. And they turned back and came to En-Meshpi, that is Kadesh, and attacked all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who dwelt in Hazmon Tamar and the king of Sodom. So now they finally get down to their target, and they interact, they conquer, they fight the five rebel Canaanite kings, the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out and joined together in battle in the valley of Siddim, and they got slaughtered. The five got slaughtered by the four against Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, titled the king of nations, so on and so forth. Four against five. Now the valley of Siddim was full of asphalt pits. So the picture we get here is after this battle, the army of the five is running for their lives to get away, and in their path of retreat are, think quicksand, think that, tar pits or quicksand, things they would fall into and it would stop them from getting away, and some of them would actually die in these tar pits. So like they run for their lives right into quicksand. So it's a horrible scene. And they fell, it says. There they took. So the four, they took, verse 11, all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah. They didn't just take rent. They took back rent. And they basically wiped them out of the five. All the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and their provisions, and they went their way. And guess who gets caught up in this? Lot. Because he had chosen land over close to Sodom. So he gets caught up in this, and he gets taken a prisoner of the four. He's probably on his way back to Babylon as a slave. They also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. And again, if they're going to get back where they came from, they can't again just go straight back across the desert. They got to go up and around. So they take their time. They're not afraid of anything. They've just slaughtered these five kings, so they take their good time and they go straight north, clear up to Syria. This is over 100 miles north before they would turn back to go east. Well, guess who's following them that they don't know about? Abram and his private army. That's what we see here. So again, verse 11, they didn't even know until it was too late that they were being followed. But this is over 100 miles of getting away, and they didn't even know they were getting away from anything. But Abram was following them. They took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah, again, verse 11. Verse 12, they took Lot. One person got away in verse 13, and he went and told Abram what had happened. One who had escaped came and told Abram, the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the terebinth trees of Mamre. Again, he was to the west of all this action. He was protected, but his nephew was not. His nephew had kind of taken advantage of him. Would a human being ever had the thought in his mind, well, he got what he had coming. He took advantage of my generosity. A totally carnal person might, but not Abram. He wasn't bitter against Lot or anything like that. He was concerned about him. So verse 14, when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his private army, 318 trained servants that were born in his own house. And he went in pursuit as far as Dan. As far as Dan. That is the far north of what we call the Promised Land. It's well over 100 miles up there. He chases down these four powerful kings and their army. And verse 15, he divided his forces against them at night. And he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus, all the way up in Syria. So he brought back all the goods, and he brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. All this loot and this back rent that these four kings had taken, he got it all back, and he heads back home. And guess who's waiting there for him, his new best friend forever? The king of Sodom, who now wants to make an alliance with Abram. And the story really gets interesting at this point. So here's this wicked man, the king over this wicked city, and he sees what has happened, and you see Abram now just loaded down with all this booty from this rescue operation, very rich, a lot of stuff, a lot of people, and now he wants to be Abram's buddy. So in the meantime, well, let's read it. King of Sodom went out to meet him in the valley of Shava, that is the king's valley, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer, and the kings were with him. And then somebody else appears out of nowhere. There's no lead up to this. Nobody sees this coming. Somebody called Melchizedek. He just pops into the story. Now, you read many people's writings on this, and they're mystified by it. Who is this Melchizedek? How is he a king? Why wasn't he a part of the five against the four? They think he's just a human king. The Church of God understands and believes that this is not a human personage. This is a pre-incarnate manifestation of the one who became Jesus Christ. Not a lot of details are given, but what details are given in the book of Hebrews describing this lead us to the firm conclusion that this is a divine being who manifested himself, at least to Abram. How many others? We don't know. Again, there's no warning that this is coming. Up until this point in the story, the only one who knew God in all of Canaan was Abram and his family. And here's a man who is the priest of the Most High God. What's he doing there, and where did he come from? Well, we put all the scriptures together. We believe this is a divine manifestation of the one who became Christ. But he interacts with Abram at this point. So verse 18, then Melchizedek, the king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. Well, who's God Most High? There's two members of the God family. And who did Christ always say was greater than him? The Father. He was the priest of the Father. Well, he still is. He still is the priest of the Father for the Church of God and for the first fruits. He's the new covenant high priest. So he's the priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And he gave him a tithe of all. And it's the first reference we know of tithing. Now, not too long ago, I was going over the doctrine of tithing in our FI online, and I read this, and we commented. Some people have a concept of tithing that's very limited. Most references in the Bible are to tithe on the increase of your field and of your flocks. And so some people have come to the rather bizarre conclusion that the only ones who have to tithe are farmers. If you raise crops or livestock, you still, to this day, have to tithe on your increase. But wage earners, people who just get paid money, they don't have to tithe. Kind of a strange conclusion. Some people actually teach that. This actually shows that tithing is not limited to agricultural produce. There is no agricultural increase in this story. This is the increase that Abram has his hands temporarily on. I mean, he's got a fabulous amount of increase from all this rescue operation. It originally had been owned by all the residents of all these other cities, and he goes and it's in his hands. And he, of all things, tithes on that to Melchizedek. And what do you think he did with the other 90%? We'll read. He gave it all away. He didn't keep any of it. But he tithed on that which he temporarily had control over, and he gave the rest of it back to its owners. He gave a tithe of all. Now, verse 21, the king of Sodom said to Abram, well, you give me the people. Let me have my citizens back, but you can keep all the back rent they collected from us. I want you to have that. Abraham would nothing to do with it. He was not going to enter into a covenant or a league or become obligated to this king of this wicked city. He wanted nothing to do with it. Look at his response. Abram said to the king of Sodom, I've lifted up my hand to the eternal God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap, and that I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, I've made Abram rich. He gave it all back. Except only what the young men have eaten. He said, here's the one exception. My servants who chased the enemy 100 miles either way and got this all back, they ate some food along the way. Please don't ask for that back. Other than that, we're not going to take anything. We're not going to keep anything. Except only what the young men have eaten and the portion of the men who went with. Now, these other kings, these other four kings, they can have their stuff back. You can give it to them, but you can't give it to me. What a story. What an incredible story. And it's a story that some people could arrive at wrong or incomplete conclusions with regard to. We've already seen a principle, haven't we? That just because you see a servant of God do something, does that necessarily mean God put his favor on it or that he initiated it? No, it doesn't. So that's one thing. Just because Abram, in this particular case, armed his servants and went back and took back all these stolen goods, doesn't endorse military involvement by the first fruits. Not necessarily. Secondly, again, we covered this in the doctrine of military service and war. God is working for the last 6,000 years on two tracks simultaneously. One we call the track of the first fruits, and the other we call the track of the world. God is not completely uninvolved in the affairs of this world. We read in the book of Romans that government officials are actually called ministers of God. God allows individuals to have powerful positions in this world's governments. But that's for people on the second track, not for the first fruits. And so God says he sometimes even puts the basest of men in power. We read about that in the book of Daniel. So we need to keep that two tracks. Now, sometimes there appears to be a little crossover, especially, and you need to pay careful attention here because it's the key, especially when it requires God to sometimes either cross over or allow certain things on a one-time basis to fulfill prophecy, to fulfill the working out of God's plan. Example, does God ever get involved in human warfare directly? Does he ever favor one army that's out killing and engaged in deadly combat with another army? Yes, he does, especially when it involves the working out of his plan for Israel. So there's no question in my mind that God is involved in secular Israel's history, military history down through time. I don't think things like the Spanish Armada getting blown halfway across the English Channel by a miraculous wind. Or you could use other examples. It teetered on the balance on Little Round Top on the second day of Gettysburg. Had that gone the other direction, I believe the whole war could have gone another direction. It was not God's purpose that this nation of Manasseh be divided into two back in the 19th century. You can think of other examples. The Battle of Waterloo. There were several miracles associated with that. It wasn't time for Reuben to conquer Joseph. And so God does intervene, even in military affairs, in his own way, for the working out of prophecy and the working out of his plan, especially when it comes to Israel, because he has a special plan for Israel. I don't think, as we read this, that it was time for Lot to be destroyed. Lot was going to later give rise to the people of Edom and Esau, the Turks. And it was not God's plan to let Lot be destroyed. And we see Abram taking certain actions, especially when he went down to Egypt, that weren't exactly right, but God didn't remove all his blessings. And I think, therefore, there are two ways for us to understand this. But the way not to understand it, you see there? The first fruits can go join the Marine Corps tomorrow. That's not the right conclusion. That's not the conclusion the church arrives at. This was a special case, and it did indirectly have to do with the working out of God's plan. Point three, we see that it was not yet time for the native tribal groups in Canaan to be dispossessed and totally conquered. God said he was going to give them more time, and only later would they be dispossessed. Well, had this raid by the four kings of the east gone unanswered, that could have led to other military and political ramifications that would have prematurely dispossessed these people, and it wasn't time for them to be dispossessed. So the four kings got a lesson, and we don't see any record that anytime soon they came back seeking back rent. So there are two or three factors to take into account as we understand this somewhat strange affair in the life of Abram. We don't ever see him taking up arms again in the same way, and we don't want to arrive at wrong conclusions in chapter 14. Like, we don't want to arrive at wrong conclusions in chapter 13 and say, okay, it's okay to lie. It's okay to doubt God and to take things into our own hands in that way. When the rest of the Bible leads us to a conclusion, we can process what we see and learn from it, as we read in 1 Corinthians 10. Okay, we'll pick it up there next time.